Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Business Roundtable. I'm your host, Vago Maradian, joining you from the Queen Mary in Long Beach, and a happy St. Patrick's Day to all. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. A modest week on Wall Street on higher than expected inflation and producer prices, dashing hopes of a Federal Reserve interest rate cut anytime soon. The federal investigation into Boeing is ramping up as airlines now project losses because of slower deliveries from the jet maker and groundings. The KC-46 tanker and the T-7 trainer as well are being delayed. But the F-35 Lightning II fighter is getting the okay for full-rate production. France's Emmanuel Macron, Germany's Olaf Scholz, and Poland's Donald Tusk agreed in Paris to do all they can to increase weapons production in Ukraine as quickly as possible. U.S. weapons makers are increasing production, but is it enough? SpaceX launches its third Starship. As reports say, the company has landed a top-secret contract for hundreds of spy satellites, and Rheinmetall posts noisy results. Joining us today to discuss all this and more are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Securities, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners, and Richard Abalafia of the Aerodynamic Advisory Consultancy. Happy St. Patrick's Day to all, especially you, Richard, because you're joining us from Dublin, en route to LA for Joanna Speed's flagship conference, the aerospace event. That starts tomorrow. I'll be joining you guys there as well. The welcome dinner is on Monday night, and the conference itself spans all day on Tuesday, and you're going to be presenting. So looking forward to your comments.
Absolutely. Really looking forward to joining the conference in LA and talking jetliners.
And you're going to be giving us a full report on flying Aer Lingus, because you're going from Dublin to LA.
Almost 12 hours. And I believe, what have we got, like six time zones or something, or seven time zones all told.
And you're going to be in fine form, as always. Everybody, thanks very much again for joining us. Ron, start us off. It was an interesting week. Interest rate, you know, the street has been sort of roaring, thinking, hey, the Fed's going to reduce prices. But then tech firms had a stumble, and, you know, the inflation and producer price figures came out, and the market seems sort of reconciled that it's like, okay, well, the rate cuts won't be happening as quickly. And obviously, the chairman's book as well. So kind of give us your sense on the week and how the group performed.
Yeah, the S&P was essentially flat on the week, right? It was down 13 basis points, which is nothing. The broader things that we look at, the 10-year yield has been trending higher. It popped up this week. It was at 4.13%, but since, call it, you know, the December-January timeframe, has been trending higher. Same with the VIX index. It's around 15. Oil prices have been doing the same thing. WTI is at 81, Brent crude's at 86. So we're seeing kind of all this stuff sort of slowly moving higher. Nothing terribly dramatic, maybe a little bit with a 10-year. You know, the big movers this week were, you know, Boeing shares were down 8%, Spirit shares were down almost 10%. On the upside, Embraer shares were up almost 9%. And then, yeah, things were, you know, just broadly sloshing around. I'd say overall, defense outperformed commercial. General Dynamics was up 1%. Northrop and Lockheed were both up about 0.5%. But things were kind of bouncing around. You know, General Electric was up 55 basis points. Raytheon was a big winner on the week, up 2.25%. But Huntington Ingalls, you know, kind of an indicator of shipbuilding, was down 1.5%. So, you know, stuff was broadly moving around. Defense generally better than commercial, and the market was flat.
You know, certainly an interesting week, and still some long range economic questions. Obviously, folks are wrestling with, right? I mean, if you want to scare yourself, you'll find reasons to try to scare yourself. Sash, give us a sense from a European perspective and how the group in Europe performed.
Yeah, it was a pretty good week on Europe, actually. The sector overall up a bit over 2%. And that, you know, that compares with European markets, or certainly the, you know, the three major European markets up just over a percent. The real standouts, I mean, let's be, you know, the standouts were defense, and particularly the two early cycle defense stories. So, I mean, Rheinmetall reported numbers that were, you know, noisy in terms of their, you know, some of the adjustments they made for 2023. But the guidance that they're giving and the indications they're giving for the next 5 years, effectively, very, very similar to Saab, which was the other great performer this week. Saab raised their guidance 2 years ago. Saab was saying, we're going to grow about 5% per annum. Then last year they said, well, actually things are going better for us. We're going to grow about 10% per annum. And then with the full year results they had about a month ago, they said, actually, nope, we're going to grow 15% per annum for at least the next 5 years. And frankly, you don't have to break into a sweat to work out how that growth is going to come through. Rheinmetall hasn't been as explicit at the top line, but when they talk about the specific product areas, and particularly, to be honest, artillery ammunition, they're going to get to the same number. They're going to be growing at least mid-teens with products that are making margins in the 20%. And that's because what European customers need is a lot more ammunition very, very fast, either to send it to Ukraine or because our own stockpiles are really, really low. Rheinmetall was up 8% last week. Saab was up 6% last week. They were absolutely standout performers. And we're going to talk about some of the other European defense teams later on. But you really can see, I think, really, the nature of a super cycle. And when the early cycle companies either get the orders, and both Rheinmetall and Saab have done, or are investing on their own account to make sure they have capacity. And again, we're seeing this from both those two companies, but others as well. The business just looks very, very strong indeed, because Europe is rearming, Europe has to rearm.
Sachin, we're going to talk about the meeting among Macron, Scholz, and Tusk a little bit later in the program to talk about sort of how all these nations are sort of marshalling to produce ammunition and weapons for Ukraine in Ukraine. And one of the biggest demands, obviously, is 152 millimeter, right, Soviet caliber ammunition that Ukraine needs, given that it has so many its entire arsenal is largely, until this war, of Soviet origin. I want to shift to you, Richard, first, though. Not a week goes by that we're not talking about Boeing as one of our top stories. There are some in our audience who wonder, God, why do they spend so much time talking about Boeing? We do that because the company is that important to the entire global aviation ecosystem, commercial and military, given that many of these are the same suppliers. This week, we have confirmation of the Justice Department criminal investigation into production issues that led to the blowout of a door plug on an Alaskan Airlines 737 MAX 9 on January 5. Now we have Alaska saying that their growth plans will be hurt, and so too their profits, because of delays getting new jets. It's like Southwest, it's got an all or Boeing fleet. And then we have a revelation that the KC-46, which has been a bleeder for the company, the tanker, the Pegasus tanker, a terrific airplane apparently in service, but delays there and delays on the T-7 trainer that has already been much delayed. Walk us through, what are the important events of the week and what do they tell us about what's next, right? Because now, even though we've been talking about these problems for 8 years now since this podcast was founded, it's the rest of folks who are saying, oh my God, Boeing's in trouble. Boeing's in trouble in a big way. And the question is, how do they get out of it? Because now people are questioning the safety of Boeing planes. Oh my God, I'm on a max. What do I do? Where do I sit? Which is not a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, we are where I guess we predicted we would be. It's almost as though there are actual consequences and financial consequences in it for really, really god-awful management. It's very strange. Who could have possibly seen? It's a very different environment. When the MAX line was shut down and the type grounded, it was, just before pandemic. So it kind of got, the losses kind of got washed out a bit because of the collapse in global flying. And this is a very different environment in which we've got this problem of the MAX ramp up, uncertainty about MAX 7 and MAX 10 certification. This is an incredibly buoyant market where people really do need the capacity, and MRO capacity is constrained too, as we've said, which means the idea of keeping planes in service longer, pulling them out of the desert or what have you, is just not that easy. So as a consequence, you've got people losing money because they can't chase demand that is extremely strong. Again, very different than after the two MAX tragedies. More losses. Lawyers will almost certainly be involved. And meanwhile, you've got, of course, problems on the defense side. The vision system for the KC-46 delayed again to make it fully operational, delayed again on the T-7. You know, probably more losses coming on just about everything. All of this is dismally predictable given the run-up to all of this and the absolute failure of senior management to change anything, anything at all. So expect more of the same. It's just kind of a horrible story in the making. And yes, it does affect everybody because ultimately this slowdown in capacity buildup is going to show up in higher ticket prices and, of course, lower, constrained environment overall. Now, there's also the very big issue of MAX 7 and 10. As you mentioned before, you've got a couple of carriers that really want these planes. We don't know when they'll be certified.
And I should point out to the audience, Richard is joining us on the move, as is often the case as we try to coordinate everybody's busy schedule. Ron, I want to bring you in and get your sense on this, right? I mean, and this is an issue we've been talking about. Richard's piece, and kudos to you, or I should say Richard's comments, in CNN have gone viral. In part, calling for, effectively management change at the company, which is something a case that Richard has made in the past. This strategy was going to work ideally, assuming the commercial aviation business was going to be the cash engine to keep underwriting losses on the defense side of the business, right? I mean, this was, I remember, this being a criticism of Lockheed guys that, look, we're disadvantaged by Boeing and the Boeing McDonnell Douglas merger is going to be terrible because now all of a sudden they have this massive commercial cash engine that'll be able to underwrite their ability to buy into defense contracts. And that's basically what Boeing has a tendency of doing and then getting into trouble for it. So what's your sense on this latest news flow and what does it mean? And at what point do you see something more dramatic from the company?
Yeah, I mean, a couple thoughts. If you look at the S&P 500 performance year to date, Boeing is the sixth worst performer out of all 500 names. So, I mean, that's sort of what the market's telling you, right? And then kind of back to your commentary around, buying into defense contracts. I guess on some level, that makes sense. If there is a hope that you can make a return on the investment, I guess the way I look at these things, if a company has to make, kind of put in quotes, an investment in a contract with the government, but there is a long enough production run or some other avenue to realistically get a return on that investment, fine, right? It's a business decision. But when you make decisions like, for example, with Air Force One, where there's only two aircraft in production and there isn't going to be international market and there isn't going to be a big logistics support contract, it makes no sense. And I would argue too, at the time, because I heard this from, some of my peers, Boeing is going to ruin the defense industry because they're buying all these contracts at a loss. That's not sustainable. I mean, we were saying that at the time, and I'll say that now, that you just can't do that, forever, because it just doesn't work. And for a lack of better cliches, I mean, the chickens are coming home to roost. And it's just made that much more difficult because things on the commercial side aren't going well. Now, I mean, a question that we get a lot currently is, what do all these headlines mean? Should I be worried about, wheels falling off of airplanes and panels and this and that? And I think investors do have to be careful about, clearly, a grand jury investigation is not a good thing, clearly. Failing 33 out of 89 FAA tests in an audit, that's not a good thing. However, you have to separate that stuff from, when you have an older fleet flying around, maintenance happens. And that's a completely separate issue, right? So, and I think the market right now gets a little bit confused between, a maintenance issue that's just totally normal versus stuff that's not, clearly kind of acceptable. So that's where we're fielding more questions from folks. And then the final piece that you mentioned, I think this is hugely important, is just the reputational damage. I mean, you can take 100 years to build a reputation. And as we're seeing now, just a matter of a few years to destroy it.
Sash, your take on this, and what does it mean, and what does it mean for the competition, right? I mean, you've been the person who's been saying that once the market dynamic shifts to a certain point, it becomes irrecoverable. Companies are now still buying Boeing airplanes because they can't get Airbus airplanes. But nobody wants to be, I think, as we've discussed on the program before, and you've made the case, you know, nobody wants to be forced into buying an airplane they might not want to buy because they need to keep the other guy honest, right? Because at some point, Airbus might figure out it can charge more money if the duopoly starts breaking down. And it doesn't look like Embraer is going to march up that chain as quickly as we had thought at some point that it would. You know, and Bombardier now is part of Airbus, right? So, I mean, there aren't even guys who could be. I mean, I guess Embraer is the last possible competitor. Anyway, give us your sense on what this does to the market dynamic more broadly. And then I want to kind of go around the horn on what has to happen to start winning confidence back, and how quickly is that even possible? I mean, you know, I mean, we all want, you know, this to be saved, but you look at retirements, right? I mean, the whole ecosystem has changed on the company. Anyway, give us your sense.
Yeah, I mean, look, first of all, huge kudos to Richard. You know, you have stuck your head well and firmly above the parapet, calling for management change. I think you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, I think that is totally necessary, even though it is not sufficient to turn Boeing around. But, you know, Boeing is not going to turn itself around with anything like the current management team or culture, particularly at the top, let alone prepare itself for how this industry will change on a 10, 15, 20, 50-year view. You know, David Calhoun is on record as saying they're not going to the company's not going to launch aircraft until they can see a long-term future for them. He's mentioned in the past, I think it was in the CNN article you were very, very well quoted in, you know, aircraft with a 50, 70, 100, 90-year life or whatever. That's never going to happen again. The pace of technological change and the requirement for this industry to get anywhere close to net zero is not going to give these long cash cow programs. So if you've got a management team that thinks that that is the status quo that they can get back to, they're the wrong management teams. You get every aircraft company is going to have, and engine company is going to have to get used to shorter production runs. It's probably going to be a less profitable industry. Suck it up. You have to get used to that now and adapt to that, rather than thinking how great the CFM56 was, how great the 737 was, how great the A320neo was. Because the word was, not will be in the future. You know, shorter production runs for the next generation is where we're going to be. As for why are airlines buying Boeing aircraft, they are buying Boeing aircraft not because they want them, but because they have to keep Boeing in business. And they're very, very well aware of that. And they're basically placing orders, particularly outside the US, they're placing orders for 737 Maxes. And they will worry about where the hell to put them, you know, in terms of their route structure later. They'll probably find a low-cost carrier subsidiary to put them into and hope they don't do too much damage because they may not be very competitive on other route structures. But they'll keep on doing that. They have to keep Boeing just about in the game. But economically, once you're outsold 2-1, you've got deep, deep trouble. And this is a cultural issue. Management has got to understand that the market share has shifted dramatically, the economics have shifted dramatically, and they've got to do so. You know, they've got to recognize that that has to be addressed if Boeing is to survive.
Ron, first, your comment on Sasha's points, right? I mean, one of the questions you could ask is, are the net zero goals even remotely achievable, right? And how realistic are they, right? I mean, we were going to electrify at a rate, right? I mean, the Hertz CEO is getting sacked because he bet big on electrification, and it's not the right time to bet big on electrification. Is that really the future of this industry, which is smaller packets of airplanes? And then the second is, what is the reasonable time frame and some of the things that have to happen? Right. I mean, it took a long time to get here. It's going to take a long time to get out, but it's not abundantly clear the company will even have the financial resources. You know what I mean? At this point, you then start to make stupid decisions and even worse decisions. And then the train just hops the tracks and somebody just buys the name, unfortunately. I mean, I don't want to sound that grim, but right, F-15 purchases are declining. The 18 is going away. It's not abundantly clear the company is going to win NGAD. they may want to throw them a lifeline, but I guess at that point the Air Force has got to be fully cognizant that you're taking a crapshoot on it, as you did on both the T-7 and the KC-46. What are the things that reasonably have to happen, and what's the speed at which they happen?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And you know, this has taken me a while to learn. Maybe some people learn it quicker than I have. Something will change, right? I've seen it many, many times, particularly with a company this important. You're given the performance in the market, given both the equity market and just the airplane market writ large, something will change. Potentially management change, who knows, but it won't stay on this track forever. I caution, it's easy to kind of jump on board with a very, very, very bearish view, forgetting that eventually things do change. Now, it's going to take time. I think your point on that is actually very good, because the problem is, it's not just, say, that Richard's thesis plays out, you have a management change, right? Well, A, who is that? B, they have to change a culture. That takes time. C, in the meantime, you've seen a lot of exits of very talented people. So you have to bring talented people back into the organization. And that all takes time.
And now, it takes money. And it takes money.
But bear in mind, it's a big company, big balance sheet. And they're not in some critical position yet where they don't have money. They do. But these decisions have to be made. But it's going to take time. Now, the good news is, on one hand, this is an industry of products that last for a long time, that have long development time frames. So, and Richard's argued this in the past, could you be a second mover and be quite successful? Of course you could. It's not like an iPhone cycle where you're developing a new product every 6 months, and it's nothing like that. So is this recoverable? Yeah. But those decisions have to be made and have to be executed. So we'll see. Now, on the net zero goals, let me go there. Here I'll be, Debbie Downer, maybe get myself in trouble for this. I think many of those goals are ridiculous at this point. I mean, again, will the industry eventually get there? Of course the industry will. Will it get there at some arbitrary date made by some regulator somewhere? It will not. Will there be another generation of engines that look and feel and operate a lot like the propulsion systems of today? Yes, there absolutely will be. Will the generation after that maybe be something different? It could be. And that's the reality of the business. If we were to see a new narrow body from Boeing or Airbus, I guarantee you it will not be hydrogen powered. It will not be electric. It won't even be hybrid. The generation after that, maybe. But now you're talking 60 years from now. So I think, like your point on EVs, it's very easy to get caught up in all the hype. But the reality is, there is a pace of change, a pace of physics understanding and technology, and a pace, this is the hugely important part, of just infrastructure build out on an industry that is global on the scale of civil aviation.
Taking a line from Richard, yours until ocean liners and zeppelins come back in service. Right, two much more efficient ways of, I don't know if they're efficient, but they were certainly cool if completely unworkable today. Sash, you've got your hand up. Go ahead. And then Richard, I'm going to come to you, and then we have to shift to the defense part of the discussion. Go ahead, Sash.
Yeah, I mean, just follow up on Ron's point. I totally agree with him. I think second mover advantage is something that companies have in the civil aeronautics industry that they have almost nowhere else. You want to see what your opponent is doing so that you can do something better. And I said, I think whoever moves second for the next generation of aircraft will produce the better aircraft. And this was a big takeaway that Airbus learned from its incredibly fumbled response to the Boeing 787, that they shouldn't have just sort of rushed in there, into everything. Take your time, come up with the you know the better product, and do it properly. So second mover advantage, tick, completely right. Development scales being longer, which sort of Ron alluded to. Yeah, and this is one of the things that worries me. Historically, we had aircraft programs that lasted roughly 30 years, and they took between 5 and 7 to develop before that. Now we've got aircraft programs, I hope they last 30 years. I have to say, this is where I disagree with Ron. I think the next could well be an interim, and it could be a 20-year program, but the damn things are taking 10 years to develop. Nobody has developed an aircraft in under 10 years this century. So please, you know, I don't want an OEM saying, oh, we can do it in 7. They can't. And they can't because the regulatory dice are totally stacked against them now. So they've got to do, you know, we've got to do something about that. And actually what that requires is a much higher level of quality assurance in the development chain so that the regulators will pass these things quicker rather than doing what the FAA and the JAA are doing, which is sitting on them because they don't like the designs. So, you know, those really be my two responses. But I do think, I think Ron and I will have to disagree on whether it's 20 years or 60 years. That's a big old gap to cover. But I agree, the next generation won't be hydrogen or electric or whatever. The question is how long that next generation is. Our view, much shorter.
Okay, now Ron's hand is up. So Richard, just your patience for a minute. Go ahead, Ron.
I would say there is one company that's done an airplane, multiple airplanes this century in less than 10 years, far less than 10 years, and that is Embraer.
There you go.
Not that they have anything in the hopper at the moment that they're going to pull a veil off of next week that's 180-seat narrow body. That said, however, everything between KC-390, all the business jets, the 195, E1 and E2, they did all of that in a span of 15 years. That's a lot of airplanes.
I would also point out, and Ron, right, when we saw the KC-390 for the first time, you said, you know what the most interesting thing about this plane is? It's a 767 diameter, right?
Absolutely.
Right. That wasn't an accident. When you would talk to Jackson and everybody, they were like, really? How about that? So, Richard, I want to bring you in on this. And any last points you want to make? And then give us a sense on, I was going to ask you this at the back of the show, but I figure it's better to ask now, right? The aerospace event is one of the Joanna puts on annually. Is really a flagship event. It's exceptionally well executed, and it really is something that's an important event for the industry. So, and you're going to be presenting there. Sort of finish up on the other points, and then want to get your sense on what are some of the themes you think we're going to be hearing at the conference.
Yeah, I mean, they're closely related, right? First of all, I think the entire industry is suddenly realizing something we've all suspected for some time, which is, as Ron says, it's another generation of conventional hydrocarbon burning turbines in one form or another, and another generation of airframes, propulsive efficiency and aeronautical improvements. But it's happening at a time where the industry has never been in so much disarray, and everyone's being asked to place their chits on a bewildering variety of possible outcomes. So you've got three turbine primes. One is preoccupied with geared turbofan. One is Rolls-Royce, preoccupied with survival. And the other is, GE is doing pretty well, but undergoing its transformation to a single market, pure play turbine company, which, is a bit of it takes time. So this is really tough for them to place bets. Now, that raises the question, since the only company that's really placing a forward-looking bet is GE with Rise, do they win, for better or worse?
Right.
And we've got the conundrum of really two airframers, Airbus has no reason to move. They show every indication of moving, to their credit, but there's nothing that's driving them. Boeing, of course, forget about it. I mean, not with this management team. Ultimately, if there is a different management team, yes, they could do a great job being a second mover. That would be terrific. but until it happens, we can't count on it happening. And yeah, Embraer, absolutely. Let's hope they scale up one day. But the 767 sized, you know, box on the KC-390 was paid for by the Brazilian Ministry of Defense in a large part. You know, it's a huge achievement if they put their own skin in the game for the commercial side of the house and go big with a 160-seater, everyone should rejoice. They'll do an amazing job. But unfortunately, if it does happen, it's not going to happen for years to come. I sure hope it happens. Anyway, there are many possible outcomes and, you know, an industry that's more in flux than ever. And of course, more tempted by the certainty of defense more than ever, because for the first time in 30 years, defense is simply booming. So it's right. Really tough to justify, you know, putting all that risk and that allocating that capital into the commercial side of the house.
Look, companies come, companies go. Once upon a time, Vickers was one of the world's largest companies. People who used to fly around on Douglas airplanes and Lockheed commercial aircraft and de Havillands, and they're just not doing it as much anymore. But about the mover advantage, just the last point I would make, I don't understand why this is considered a new lesson. Boeing with the 247 moved first. Douglas is the one that cleaned up the market with the DC-3 or, you know, DC-123, right? And then if you want to jump farther forward, de Havilland came out with the Comet, groundbreaking, had a whole series of problems that they didn't anticipate in the wake of crashes, and Boeing cleans up with the 707. Right. I mean, so these sorts of changes happen and have happened throughout aviation, where there is sort of a second mover advantage often, ultimately. Right. I mean, Richard, you would make the case the DC-8 was a better airplane than the 707, you know, ultimately. Let me, Richard, transition quickly to, and I should say the defense that Joanna every October and this October in Washington will be convening a defense event. Which is really a terrific gathering. I just submit that people should put that on their calendars. I'm going to be moderating. Richard, you'll be there, and many, many other luminaries. Let me shift gears. F-35, full rate production decision. That's good, but the numbers are still low because, you know, there are customers, including the U.S. Air Force, that are waiting for the better version of the airplane than the current airplane that's being produced. Walk us through what the full rate production decision means.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem. It's not really clear what it means. They've demonstrated that they can get to the 140s. They've no intention of getting to 156. That is to say, beyond 156. The market would support 250. but right now, the plan is 156, which hopefully with TR-3 Block 4 clear, they'll be able to get to. But, you know, the only thing I can hope for, well, two things. One is that FRP, you know, full rate production approval, allows for multi-year procurement contracts. That might allow them to get costs down a bit, but already I don't think it's going to get down that much more. As a matter of fact, I think it was last year that was the first time in the history of the program's cost rose a little because of inflation. That had already been, you know, the cost had already been coming down quite a bit. So I'm not so sure what full rate production gets. It might embolden people to facilitize upward and maybe later this decade get to 170, 180, which the market could certainly support. But beyond that, it's at this point almost kind of procedural.
And a quick word from our sponsors. The Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by Bell, HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, GE Aerospace, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. Sash, important meeting in Paris. Emmanuel Macron, as usual, deserves a little bit of credit for always driving the defense conversation forward, even if there are those who say he doesn't, you know, he occasionally might trip in doing it. But, you know, he has been clear that Russia has to lose, that Ukraine has to not only win, but Russia has to lose. And, you know, especially as the United States has been a little bit slower in delivering weapons, there are a lot of questions about whether or not this is purely because the money's run out, or whether or not the inventory stocks are getting so low that we're worried about giving any more to the Ukrainians, which is a concern, because we have been really pulling out all the stops and the consumption rates for everything have been fantastic, as is the case, as you've made the case, right? You're always burning through everything a lot faster when real wars happen. Macron, Scholz, and Tusk agreed to do all they could to do it quickly to help Ukraine rearm. Obviously, the question of Taurus cruise missiles came up. A bit of pressure on Scholz to change his mind on that decision and get those weapons over. From your standpoint, what were the takeaways from that meeting? And how likely is that going to be to move the needle?
I would be inclined to say that it won't move the needle very much, but the needle is moving anyway, pretty much of its own volition. So, you know, this meeting itself, I mean, a number of things about this meeting. First of all, was that the fact that it was a tripartite meeting between France, Germany, and Poland clearly irritated a lot of other European countries. And my response to that would be, well, you know, if you actually just got on with the job of supplying Ukraine with a lot of arms and so forth, you'd probably have been invited to the meeting anyway. But, you know, Europe, when people get or when countries get upset about bilaterals, trilaterals, it brings out the worst in European politics. The point about manufacturing in Ukraine is a really, really interesting one. Why manufacture in Ukraine? One, because it's cheaper. They've got a ton of capacity. They've got very, very low labor costs. What they haven't got is the money to start production of whatever product they want, whether it's 155 millimeter ammunition or 102 millimeter ammunition or armored vehicles or guns, whatever. But they've got the capabilities. It's just their industry, like everybody else's, was run down in the 90s, 2000s and early teens. And they haven't had the money to build up production, anything like they want. So very interesting Financial Times article covering this meeting, which highlighted that Ukraine estimates they have the capacity to build around $18 billion worth of defense equipment. And that's mainly guns, ammunition, vehicles. But they've only got the funding, generally from Europe, to do about half that. So there's this untapped ability to produce stuff in Ukraine, which could be done a whole lot cheaper and therefore probably much quicker than it would be than ramping up capacity in Western Europe. And I think that's a really strong argument. The other argument, frankly, is that from Ukraine's point of view, brings Europeans even tighter into supporting Ukraine. And this may be something that actually panics some European governments, but once you've got a factory which has got, at least as one of the name tags on the board, Rheinmetall or BAE Systems or Saab or General Dynamics even, the government country concerned is probably going to do quite a lot more to look after that plant, the European employees in it and so forth. And so Ukraine's, you know, game plan, which is to tie Europe even closer to its fortunes, I think is an entirely rational one. I can see why some European countries rather balk at that. Taurus. What's happening with Taurus? Taurus is a very, very, very competent medium long range cruise missile. It is broadly analogous to the Franco-British Scalp Storm Shadow. There's a lot of sort of contests on Twitter about my cruise missile is better than your cruise missile. Let it wash over. The fact is, these are broadly 350 to 500 nautical mile cruise missiles, very, very accurate against hard targets. These are what you need if you are going to bring the Kerch Bridge down, and you probably need many dozens of them. But they, you know, they're very, very hard to stop, and they're incredibly effective once they hit. Germany is having a real attack of nerves about exporting Taurus. Why? Because to target it super accurately, i.e. with the terrain control profiling rather than just with GPS. GPS anybody can do, frankly, but it's jammable. But once you do it so that it's non-jammable, you need either to reach back into Germany and have German servicemen target it, which is supposedly, I say that with tongue in cheek, what's happening with the Storm Shadows and the Scalp PGs that the British and French have supplied, or you need to have national servicemen forward in Ukraine doing this highly classified targeting, which may also be happening with other weapons. Germany is having a really bad attack of nerves about this, which I think points to the effectiveness of the Russian disinformation process. The Russians are saying, if Western countries get involved, that is escalation, and we will then escalate further. And Putin is brilliant at this, and it really works in Germany. which is a great shame. Other countries seem less concerned about this at the moment. And remember, every time he gets bad, he threatens to use nuclear weapons because he knows that that will panic an even wider section of politicians. So the, you know, come back to the original point: is this going to change the supply of weapons to Ukraine? Not much, not immediately, but the supply of weapons is increasing. And I think your point about President Macron is a really interesting one. I think France has grasped something that other European nations have grasped, which is that Europe cannot afford to let Ukraine lose. Now, that's fairly widely held. But France is also looking at the situation on the ground, in the air and in the sea, and saying some of those conditions are getting tantamount to Ukrainian defeat. What does the Ukrainian defeat look like? Russians advance to the Dnieper River. Russians achieve air superiority over Ukraine. The Russians cut off Odessa and the other Black Sea ports and prevent the export of grain. Now, in reverse order, at the moment, the Ukrainians can pretty much export what they want, but Odessa comes under fire. The Russians are a long way away from the Dnieper River, except down in the south, but they could well establish air superiority if they can attrit Ukrainian air defenses enough. That's getting pretty damn close, and that's a really uncomfortable position to be in. So escalation, or the risk of Ukrainian defeat is recognized. Escalation is a real possibility, but different European countries are going to accept that and address it in different ways, which never makes Europe look terribly nice. But, you know, we're generally quite good at doing, as it was always said about America, the right thing after the wrong things have all been exhausted. Fingers crossed.
We've got about 5 minutes left on the program, and I think it's going to be very interesting to see whether or not Ukraine at some point, becomes that armorer for Europe, I think there are so many lessons from this war, and that the Ukrainians, in many respects, hopefully when it's over, are going to have a very bright future applying, all of the innovation that they've been able to demonstrate on the battlefield elsewhere and across their society, frankly. Very quickly, let me get your sense. We discussed a little bit the noisiness of Rheinmetall's earnings. Just give us a little slightly deeper dive, and I want to go then to Ron on the SpaceX news. Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Rheinmetall is a company that's changing. It's getting rid of a lot of its civil automotive related businesses, but that causes noise. There are charges, there are some discontinued items, and so forth, and that makes it sometimes quite hard to see the wood for the trees in an individual set of results. But on the other hand, the munitions businesses, the armored vehicle businesses, the trucks businesses, the defense electronics businesses are really starting to accelerate now. And I think that they had quite a lot of cutoff effects right at the end of last year. They built trucks for various European governments who then said, actually, we really want to take delivery of them in January, not December. It's an accounting thing, but it always makes the numbers look a bit odd when you have a big buildup of stocks and right, you didn't get the cash in that you expected. Same thing with ammunition. Why governments do it is, it's a mystery. But eventually they take delivery of the product, whatever it is. The fact is, the demand is now there. And as I said earlier on the program, the underlying business is really starting to accelerate. Just to make clear to some of our listeners, what it is that makes Rheinmetall tick. This is a company that had revenues last year of just over 7 billion. It'll have revenues in 2027 on our forecast of about 14 billion. So, it nearly doubles over that period. And within that, and this is the really impressive thing, the weapons and ammunition division, 1.6 billion of revenues last year, that grew to about six. So over 2027, 5.3. That more than triples in size. And that is hugely driven by 155mm ammunition and medium caliber cannon. They make almost no rifle ammunition at all, and amen to that, because anybody can do that, but very few people can make 155. So this is the problem with the defense buildup. It's a flywheel. It takes time to come through. We're over 2 years since the invasion of Ukraine, but it's starting to come through now, and you'll see it in Rheinmetall's results in the next 3-5 years.
Fascinating, and it's astonishing how the company has been able to, as we've discussed on the program, surge production. The thing is, we need more production. Ron, I want to kind of jump back to you, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General C.Q. Brown, visited arms factories last week, talked to among others, folks at Lockheed Martin about increasing production, the need for partnership, the need for the department to work with its suppliers to get everything moving more quickly. Tony Capasio of Bloomberg had a great story on that, and basically said HIMARS production has gone from 48 to 60, and I think we'll get to 96 at the end of the year, if my notes are correct. 96. Is that good enough? Or is this relative to where we were? Holy smokes, that's fast.
Well, it's taken a while, right? I mean, we've been talking about the story now for since, I mean, the beginning.
2 years.
Yeah, I mean, the Ukraine war, right? So, and we've said that it takes a while for the flywheel to get going, and we're seeing that, right? And that shouldn't be that big a surprise. And I would expect across other contractors that are, tied to replenishing inventories of you name it, you're going to start to see higher volumes start to really go out the door, right? And that was the thing that when the war broke out, I think investors immediately jumped in and said, who's going to benefit from this? And there was not a clear understanding that benefit isn't, in 3 months, it takes time. No, that time has come. So I would expect to see that across the sector. So, is 96 enough? I honestly don't know, but I mean, it's better than what they were doing, clearly, right?
Yes. in short, but we're also finding that, just about everything is, I don't want to use the term derailing, but I mean, continuing resolutions are having a deleterious effect across the board, and not approving the supplemental. A huge chunk of the supplemental is rearmament for the Pentagon. Sash has got a bailout in a minute. Sash, give us your quick take on Naval Group winning in the Netherlands. I'm sorry, I should have put that on the list. Go ahead, give us your quick take.
This is the Netherlands' requirement to replace their 4 Walrus-class submarines, which have been tremendous, performers, conventional submarines for NATO, highly capable, but also highly old, even by the standards of submarines. And there's been a very, very fierce competition going for 4 new conventionally powered submarines. The it finally shortlisted Naval Group, ThyssenKrupp, and Saab. And I think slightly surprisingly, Naval Group has won with what they're calling a conventional variant of the Barracuda submarine. Now, the Barracuda submarine is a nuclear-powered submarine with a displacement of 5,000 to 6,000 tons. So I think to produce a conventional submarine of that scale would be a remarkable achievement of itself. I think the Naval Group has actually benefited from a lot of the design work they were doing for the Australian attack class, which is, right. Listeners remember, were cancelled when the AUKUS deal was announced. But this is a very, very important win for Naval Group. Clearly disappointing, I think, particularly for Saab, who were teamed with a Damen Group in the Netherlands, but also for ThyssenKrupp, which has been the leading European submarine maker. So this is going to change, I think, the dynamics of submarines in Europe a bit, but it really is going to tilt the competition for the Canadian submarine program, which is the next really big one coming up. And that's for nearly twice as many subs.
It's going to be interesting, and really RDM, right? Great submarine maker, Dutch homegrown submarine maker, and some questions now about what the future is for Saab in this business. We'll talk a little bit more about that next week. Sash, thanks very much. Richard, thank you, because both of you are on very tight timelines. Ron, you're on a slightly longer timeline. Let me get your sense on the SpaceX award. As far as we can tell, the Wall Street Journal in February reported, I think originally the story that SpaceX was executing a top secret spy satellite contract. And Reuters has confirmed or has reported that the National Reconnaissance Office is that customer. It's a $1.8 billion contract to launch hundreds of imaging satellites. Prototypes were flown in 2020. The contract was signed in 21, according to news reports, and deliveries are going to begin soon. And that makes an enormous amount of sense, right? The company's already launched 5,000 Starlink spacecraft. So where better to tuck in reconnaissance satellites than in those vast fleets of commercial spacecraft, right? I mean, it's brilliant. And the company, you know, SpaceX has demonstrated it can move fast. And this is a pretty fast moving capability at a time. The United States is saying we need a distributed imaging and satellite network, given that our adversaries are going to target our large spacecraft. And that this the goal of this is ubiquitous global surveillance. You know, obviously, NRO in the past has hosted its payloads on commercial spacecraft as well. What are the implications of this award ultimately, and what does it say for the big primes that are still in the business of making very, very big satellites, the kinds of which the looks like the department is moving away from?
Well, I mean, on that point, I mean, there's been a debate between the proliferated satellites, like the type that SpaceX has, versus the exquisite. And I think even the big primes today would say, hey, you know what, things are going proliferated. Now, you know, that's fact. I guess, you know, the good news is for SpaceX, they won this. The bad news for the primes is they could have won it, maybe had they had the technology and so on and so forth, but they didn't. You know, there's a new player in the space game, but you know, SpaceX isn't that new anymore, right? I mean, you've got an experienced player in space with a legacy in both launch and satellite systems who's, you know, competing with everybody else for, you know, government contracts. And they appear to be doing, you know, a good job. Now, like you mentioned, I mean, having this mixed in with, you know, the Starlink system, you know, hundreds of these, you know, spy satellites, you know, potentially with you want to call it sort of a swarming imaging capability that you could, you know, really nail down images in any part of the world at any time, almost instantly. I mean, that's really powerful, right? So, from a strategy perspective, it makes a ton of sense. You know, why try to get another contractor up to speed doing all this when you have one that knows how to do it and has executed it pretty darn well? So you know, the details, other than, you know, some of the numbers that you talked about that are out in the press, is, you know, clearly because of the sensitive nature of this, we don't know a ton about it. But I mean, I would assume from our vantage point now that, you know, this is, you know, makes a ton of sense, and, you know, it's good to see.
If you look at it, right, I mean, right now the fear we have is, you know, grappling, dazzling, you know, kinetic means of taking out satellites, right? I mean, we've seen the Russians, you know, satellite disgorges a satellite that disgorges something else. And I think we've even seen that from the Chinese. So, you know, it's certainly the best way to get lost in the background is just one of a number of Starlink satellites, just minding my own business here. That's not to say that that whole string won't get targeted, right? But it's a different challenge.
But I mean, think about it. I mean, why did the internet happen in the first place, right? So right. It's same thing, but in space with images. So it makes a ton of sense.
Yep, indeed. Everybody, thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Richard, looking forward to spending the day, the next few days with you here out in sunny California. Thanks very much again for joining us. We'll be back again tomorrow with the Look Ahead program with Byron Callen of Capital Alpha Partners. And tune in to our program on Tuesday with Dr. Eugene Rumer of the Carnegie Endowment and our friend Sam Bendett of the Center for Naval Analyses. We're going to be analyzing Vladimir Putin's electoral landslide victory in Russia and what's next in the Ukraine war, especially as Ukraine is executing some very impressive deep strikes on Russia. Thanks very much again for joining us. We'll see you again tomorrow. Until then, have a great day.